All the Rage with John Bowd on www.traxfm.org.
Hello again, listeners. Welcome to All the Rage. And I have a guest with me again this week. Please introduce yourself, sir.
Hi there. Yes, I'm Adam. Adam Thatcher. I'm a PhD student, kind of part of the time. And part of my work and what I use to actually kind of finance the other part of the time, essentially, is doing work in the gig economy. So it's partly what I study, but it's also, it pays the bills, if that makes sense. It pays the rent, just about. Particularly, there's kind of two types of work. There's one bit which is kind of food delivery, and I think the bit that we might be talking a bit more about today is... how can I put it? It's kind of cloud work, I suppose, micro work. It's doing writing tasks online or filling in surveys and blogs and all this kind of stuff. Just kind of greasing the wheels of the back end of the internet a little bit and getting paid very, very minor, very micro amounts of money for the pleasure of doing it.
That's a very good introduction to what we want to talk about, I think. Yeah. Just to fill the listeners in, I met you at the launch of a zine called The Invisible Worker. Very, very interesting thing put together by Robbie Warren and featuring yourself and a few other writers. One in particular piece that you, which I think links into what we're going to talk about tonight, is republished here, and it was Reflections on Writing Conspiracy Theories by yourself. Tell us what that's about and where it comes from and how that links into the kind of micro work you were talking about.
Yeah, of course. So there's kind of almost like two types of these micro jobs, I guess. A lot of it is filling in surveys and doing image recognition and things like that. So it's the things that, you know, no matter how powerful the machines are at the minute, essentially, and how powerful the algorithms are, there's certain things that humans are really kind of naturally good at. So it might be going through pictures on websites and filtering out the ones that are pornographic. It might be going through Facebook comments and looking at sentiment analysis, so saying, oh, well, what do they actually mean by this? Or it might be training AI. But this article is on that other end of the work, which is kind of basically almost like a content mill. It's responding to longer form writing tasks, not massive by any means. You know, I'm not writing anyone's dissertation or anything. It's more kind of like blog content, or reworking the news, I suppose, which is the kind of form this one took in the end. But essentially you get a set of tasks by somebody, who you don't always know the identity of. You don't usually know what the piece is going to end up being used as or used for, but you do get some basic instructions to write on. So mine was turning, in this one in particular, it was turning a Russia Today article into a web, a kind of blog piece for, how they put it, I've got the description in front of me. So the brief was to take the following Russia Today article, Russia stockpiles gold in a continued push away from the US dollar, and transform it into unique content for our blog, which is left unnamed. Our readers are into conspiracy theories. So it was a nudge, a subtle nudge, to turn something already a little bit conspiracy-y into something really quite conspiracy-y.
What you also played at the event was a very interesting sound recording for where that sort of ended up somewhere entirely different, you know, unknown to you.
Yes.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Yeah, so basically the wonders of Google, I suppose. Often when you write these pieces, you don't see what happens to them. You never get to see them in their final form. But obviously with Google, you can just kind of search whole paragraphs, right? And you get a very small amount of results back. So I searched basically a paragraph of what I'd written, because the ignorance of his bliss wasn't really cutting it with this one, that you usually get with most of the jobs. And it took me through to a website called disclose.tv. So they kind of put a shy on it and turned it into an article. And then kind of second or third down on the Google results was a YouTube link. And I thought, hey, what? I didn't make a video, you know. And essentially clicked through, and it was exactly my article, obviously rebranded under something else, for the Alternative News Network. And it basically, I know.
Yeah.
And it was a robotic voice, essentially, reading through my article, literally kind of like machine reading. Which creeped me out entirely. It's this afterlife of what you've written, if that makes sense, just gets totally kind of made weird.
Yeah, it just turns into something that's nothing to do with what you wrote, and it's completely used as a tool, basically, for someone else's gain.
Absolutely. I might be able to find it. Shall I have a look?
Yeah, if you'd like to. Yeah, we'll pop that in. Maybe if you send us a file so we can...
Maybe that could be my song at the end.
Yeah, exactly. we can put a techno beat behind it.
Yeah, absolutely. That'd make it better.
Just repeat Russian gold, Russian gold, Russian gold over to the end. Warehouse style. So where did you come into this work? Tell us a bit about the websites and where did this first sort of get recommended to you, this strange netherworld of internet work?
So again, sadly, it ends up starting with Google. It was one of these, it was when I was an undergrad, actually, was when I kind of started fishing around doing some of this. And I think the exact thing I typed in was how to make money fast, essentially. And one of the things it suggests is doing this kind of micro work. You can do it from home with a laptop you've already got, assuming you've got one. And it's uber flexible is the idea, right? So you just log on and knock off a couple of jobs and you've made actually not very much money at all. But that's the sort of idea, and that's where it came from. It was just a desperate need for cash and no way to get a job in the situation that I was in. I was in a very small university town where all the jobs for students had been taken up essentially already, and my student loan evaporated into God knows what. So it was just a need for quick cash, which then obviously decreases the amount that you can work for. Well, not happily, but you know what I mean? It decreases the amount you'll accept if you've got certain things to pay that you just need to pay and there's no other way out. So that was where it all started. I guess that's where it came up on the radar. And then as I've got on, I've managed to get into kind of studying work, essentially. I've been quite lucky in the respect that I've managed to stay in the university system. And then I was kind of sit there and thought back to this, if that makes sense. Initially, I was going to think about warehouses and kind of call centres and logistics. But actually, as I started thinking about this, it seems symptomatic of the problem that work is globally distributed. In a lot of ways, it's very low quality work for very low pay. And it has all of the elements of, you know, I mean, we're looking at the wrong end of capitalism. It's got all the elements of alienation possible, essentially. Yeah. I didn't know where it was going when it arrived on the internet, and I found it was under a different name. With this one in particular, it was done something totally else, totally other, which I had no idea about, and I stumbled upon it, and I never would have if I would have just not Googled a paragraph of it. So not only have they made their money twice out of me, essentially, I'm actually making things with no knowledge of to what end that they're being made for.
This is a form of employment where you have no idea of really who you're working for. There's just a website that's clearly like a kind of middle person.
Yeah, I mean, and the platforms are really, well, they're good at, but it's terrible, but they're very experienced in and kind of professional at standing back and holding their hands up and saying, no, this is nothing to do with us. We're just the meeting space. And you know, what people request on there and what jobs people do, as we are not liable for any of that. We'll have some rough guidelines. But, I mean, equally then, the worker has to put in their own guidelines because stuff inevitably slips through the net, right? So for me personally, this was pushing...
What should your guidelines be when, if you really don't want... Yeah, benefiting, you know... For want of a better term, let's look at the alt-right, for instance. You don't want any of your stuff benefiting those people.
Absolutely. So this was, it's to date the only kind of piece that I've done that's spun off into conspiracy writing in this way. And I kind of half did it just to see what it would be like. And this is at the very tame end of some of the more serious tasks that people are asking for. But there is stuff that is really kind of, it's not even hiding about being an alt-right content mill. I think that's probably even more concerning, right? So I found the video. This has 259 views, of which actually probably other people were paid to watch it, right? It's a task. So it's not gone very far. But I've seen jobs listed up there to be kind of, make up a hate crime in middle America and write a piece about it. Make up a crime that somebody from the Afro-American community has done, or the Muslim community, and just write a piece and pretend it happened. Now, obviously, I don't do those, but it's dangerous that they're out there, and there's very little recourse to report the job, if that makes sense, or to suggest that there's any issue, because the platform is so stand-backish. So people that are more desperate might well end up, if they're the only jobs that are left, almost feeling forced into doing them.
There's so much I find horrifying and fascinating about this kind of work, the complete kind of disconnectedness of it. And I want to come back to that in a minute, because I want to delve into that a little bit more. But I'm also thinking about, I'm just going to take a trade union rep's perspective here for a minute. You sign up for one of these jobs, two of these jobs, whatever. Say you spend a whole day knocking these things out. You expect to have a pay packet in the bank at the end of the day. It's not there. Maybe you write to the site and say, what's going on here? And they say, fuck off, we don't care. Or something like that. I mean, there's no way to even enforce your rights at something like this. Is there, or have I missed something?
No, exactly not. So basically, there's a lot of these kind of platforms, this kind of work, have a caveat where if the what they term as the requester, so just the person requesting the work to be done, what from a kind of trade union point of view, and what I think of is essentially this kind of employer, right? But they call them, it's part of the veneer of legalese that lets them get away with this kind of behaviour. So they'll say the requester, if they find that the work wasn't up to scratch, don't have to pay you. And there's very little avenue for recourse after that. Very, very little. So essentially you can end up just not getting paid without any chance to really redeem it. You're also worried that if you push it too far, you might get kicked off the platform. Or for example, some requesters will leave an email on a job. If you jot it down and they don't pay you and you email them, you think, what if I get a bad rating, and then I'm just kicked off the platform again? Or even if I'm still on the platform, nobody will want me to work for them. So not only is there very little avenue for by arbitrating any disagreements at all, there's also the double concern of, well, what if I just try and get this solved? What might the recourse be coming back? That will limit my potential opportunities for work in the future. And it is quite a common practice, especially with smaller jobs, for them to just not pay. And then when you look back on it, you think, it was only 3p, for Googling something. Bugger it, it's not worth. It's not worth the amount of time it's going to take to chase it up. But then, of course, got the work. So symbolically, of course, it's worth chasing up. And as a kind of point of order, it's worth chasing up. But if you're doing work for 3p a job, it means you're probably rushed off your feet doing hundreds of them. And they know that, right? That's the power play that they totally utilise.
Doing work that doesn't really mean anything, that pays so little that, as you say, it can't really seem to be worth fighting it. And this whole thing, I mean, to kind of spin off for a second from the main point, I've always had a great dislike as part of the gig economy, this review thing. It's obviously, it takes a notion which I think is very positive, which is a customer's ability or a client's ability, whatever other term, awful term you want to use, to kind of review something that they have taken part in or that they've been provided with or what. But at the same time, it turns everything into if you piss me off, I'll give you a bad review. Also, from the other side, and listen, no offence to any Uber drivers that are listening, but, I understand that's a tough job, and we're all in favour of their unionising activities over on this show. But at the end of you giving me a lift somewhere, I really can't be bothered to go and have to give you a review somewhere. Don't take that the wrong way. I just don't. It's not, you know, if a cab driver picks me up, we get to the end, I pay him some money, I maybe give him a tip, and then I never have to see him again.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and what's interesting is, as well, as far as I'm aware, that, for example, Uber drivers rate the customers, right?
Yeah.
But basically, as a customer, you can just not do it, and the notification goes away. But as far as I'm aware, as a driver, you pretty much have to do it. Like, it becomes part of the labour process.
Yeah.
But you're not paid for rating them. You know what I mean? So it's building up Uber's whole suite of data that it holds on customers, but you're receiving no financial incentive to do it. It's just another part that's tacked onto the labour process of driving. So even within that, like, you're absolutely right. It's trying to push people towards reviews, but as a worker, it's even more pressure to do the review, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's like one of those sort of things. Hey, can you just do this on the way out? And it's another duty that you know, that you're not just doing on the way out the office, as it were, of an evening. It's just more things that's added on to you and not getting paid for.
Yeah. And as well, it's what, you know, Uber don't say to the customers when they say, can you rate, is so basically, from what I understand, if you put no rating at all, it doesn't count towards anything. So that's fine if you just ignore it. But it's annoying that it keeps popping up. But basically, Uber, they don't tell the customers, but they do definitely very much so tell the drivers, is that you need to maintain an average of 4.4. And if you don't, you get kicked off the platform. And 4.4 is enormous. And, like, ratings are taken differently by everyone, right? Like, there's those people that are kind of like, there's never the perfect 10, you know? So this boils down, well, it has to be amazing to get a 5. So they'll give a 4, thinking that means, oh, he was really good, but, you know, he didn't give me dinner in the car.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's actually contributing towards them losing their job, which isn't the customer's fault. It's Uber's fault for setting these ridiculous arbitrary, like, boundaries, and they're not telling anyone where they sit.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's the kind of thing where they don't let you know what it is you're required to do in order to meet this. They'll just let you know if you haven't done it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You only know when they tear your license up in front of you and you're like, nah.
Yeah. Ugh. Obviously didn't make it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's very grim. So there's many things I could pontificate on this one, but I think I'll try and stick to the point, which makes a change from my usual thing. But yeah, I was just thinking about how this, coming back to the sites that you were talking about, where you have this sort of strange... actually, no, I suppose this applies to Uber and that sort of thing too. This kind of like a modern, disconnected electronic version of standing outside the factory of a morning hoping to be picked for work.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. Yeah, I mean, the difference is there's a hell of a lot of jobs on these sites. Just lots of them are shit.
Yeah.
So what you want is, it's not like putting your hand up and that's 100% of a day's work or nothing. It's that, am I going to have to drill through horrid jobs that I hate or just ones that I really dislike?
or even, importantly, as you brought up, jobs that are deeply morally questionable.
Yeah, exactly.
Because one of the problems we have with us, still have today, I think, with the world of work, and especially for people on the kind of lower earnings end of work and stuff like that, is a kind of idea of, look, just take what you're given. And, you know, you're not in a social or economic position to have a moral basis for what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
No one's ever necessarily said that out loud, but to me it seems very, very apparent.
It's absolutely what they're thinking, I think. You know, and I think it's also, you see the gig economy banded around in the press all the time and by politicians, but implicitly a lot of the time. So, you know, when Theresa May says, oh, unemployment's the lowest it's ever been. And actually, no, it's not. Well, we have underemployment, right? We have very precarious employment in... And I'm not saying it's a totally new thing. But it's almost... It seems like the kind of... Almost like the wet dream for politicians who want to uphold this free market economy, right? And obviously, within that, the thing they don't say, because it makes them look like the bad guys that they might well be, is that, well, in a free market economy, you need a certain level of unemployment, right, to create competition. And to keep wages relatively suppressed. Because if anyone could just walk out of a job one day and walk into another, then obviously they're in higher demand. So the gig economy allows the politicians to say, we have no unemployment, we're at nearly full employment, whilst also maintaining the competition, because people are still actively hunting for jobs quite a lot of the time. Does that make sense?
No, it makes perfect sense.
So it's become like a double-edged sword.
Yeah, that's a very good way of explaining it. It's very much the nightmare of the modern world of work. Which is why you need a union, folks.
Absolutely.
Moving on slightly, I just wanted to kind of ask, and I'm being a bit abstract here, so if these questions seem a bit weird, then you know, please just don't worry about it. What effects do you think this kind of work has, not just on the individual and their life, but a kind of understanding of the world of work, or even on the wider public psyche? I mean, if I'm thinking back, for instance, when I was in school, and I'm sure you had this, where a careers advisor shows up, and never the most scintillating conversation you've had anyway, but at least when I left school, they were saying, well, you could have an office job, or you could go somewhere like this, and now it's, I mean, how does a careers advisor show up with this under his arm to try and sell it to you?
It's demoralising, isn't it? I mean, to be fair, the careers advisor at my school told me to be a careers advisor, so that was quite a meta experience early on. The perfect career for you would be a careers advisor. Is that just what happens when they have no answers left? You know,
I think so. I can't find anything for you, mate. Fuck it, do what I do.
Exactly. It's all right. It pays the bills. It is a career, you know. But yeah, I think the way that this boils down into schools and universities now, I mean, it was starting to come through when I was just finishing university, is that it's you can be a freelancer and build the portfolio career, right? Which is the upper end of the gig economy, where people are actually earning quite good money. They might be working on design work or something like that and having big contracts with big corporations. But that's the way they position it. And actually, when you look down, what most of us will end up having to do if we do want to be freelancers, which I'm not entirely convinced I do want to be, is the shit work a lot of the time, right? And the stuff that you just have to churn over and over and over. But I mean, in the West, this work isn't done that much because the money is so low. It becomes more of an emphasized issue when you look to places where what's the measure they use to bring in the relative values of money, but basically where, you know, the kind of $4 or $5 goes a hell of a lot further. So this is kind of the tip of an iceberg here, and the experience gets far more drawn out and far more widespread and complicated. But yeah, I think in terms of the way it's presented in careers, I think we're sold the dream, or some people have sold the dream of being a freelancer with all these clients and the freedom to work from Thailand, if you like, you know. All you need is your shiny MacBook and you can make a fortune from a beach hut somewhere with Wi-Fi, which is obviously a crock of shit for most people. But that's the shiny way of saying it. Reality ends up being seriously different.
Yeah, I think they're sort of saying is parts of the world where your money goes further means the only way we can pay you as little as this. So you won't be working in that beach yard, you'll be living in it, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the justification for the low wages across the board.
Yeah.
You know, is that it, because then it becomes, and this is something that I've been struggling with thinking about, to be honest, is how as workers do we come together to do this? Because it's becoming a race to the bottom. And you know, it's not for me to say to somebody living in far different circumstances, you shouldn't take that work because if we work together we can raise the price of this, because my circumstances and theirs are probably going to be kind of qualitatively different, but equally how can we start to form a position for collective bargaining through this? I haven't found it yet, whatever it is. And I think that's one of the worrying things, is it's global. And as much as it would be like lovely to have these global collective bargaining agreements, getting there with people that are so precarious already, I haven't even got close to thinking of a way in. essentially, with a lot of it.
Well, that's maybe somewhere, something that those of us who are existing union reps should be thinking about. And actually, I have thought about this quite a lot. I'll be honest, though, I've had trouble coming up with it. You know, I have been watching the youth in places like Deliveroo and other such places and the restaurant industry to see where they go. But still, there's a much stronger physicality to what they do than the work that you're doing here. Do you think, or do you have any idea of what the sustainability of all this is? I mean, where is this going? What's the goal for people who own companies that do this?
So I think a lot of the time the companies that use it, rather than the people that own the platforms, basically the platforms are rent seeking. I think that's their main mode of operation, is to just take a little bit of the transaction for as long as it lasts. It's a relatively low cost business to run once it's there. But I think for a lot of the companies that use these platforms, it's a saving measure to not have to kind of make a machine do the job. For example, it could be quite expensive to write the code for something that does image recognition. I mean, stuff like this freer blog writing is impossible at the minute, but it stops them having an in-house writer, right? So I've become weaponized at undermining who would formerly be an employee. So it gets wrapped up in these really complicated games. And this is where, you know, the old consultant line comes in and goes, oh, you know, like, all you have to do is shift some of your costing so you make more profit and your shareholders be happy. What's your biggest cost? Employees. How do we cut that cost? Fire them and outsource it to the rest of the world. And this is allowing a whole new level of outsourcing of lots of different things.
Looking away from us workers for a minute.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think it all comes back to us anyway. We have to have the solution here somewhere. But nationally, possibly internationally, but definitely nationally, what can government... I mean, if we were looking for a government to kind of instigate a law against this kind of thing happening, what do you imagine that would look like?
I mean, there's the far out ideas, which actually aren't that far out. But I mean, people are going to take a lot of convincing of things like UBI, for example, would kill something like this. Basically, there's no need to do it anymore if there was enough just to sustain yourself. Right, you're not doing this job to get rich because you're never going to earn enough to do it. It's just to sustain. So something that doesn't address it, but would knock the foundations out from underneath the industry, I think could be effective.
Yeah.
Alternatively, looking at how these companies are taxed, I don't know what the tax situation is of the platforms. But it seems to me that there's a huge amount of revenue in transactions, essentially, like microtransactions coming from the supplier, the requesters of work down to these globally dispersed workers. And I don't know whether there's something to be said for looking at where these companies are essentially based for tax purposes and seeing if it can be made more. Yeah, I don't really know.
No, I mean, I think that where you're going there is interesting, but as far as the ability for tax avoidance is difficult there. Certainly a universalising of income, or if not that, certainly services, universal basic services would relieve some of this.
Absolutely.
And like you say, I mean, I think it's an issue of trying to get the, if you can't actually legislate against the work that they're doing, then just take their legs out from under them.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Make it redundant, I suppose, in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Make the job redundant.
Yeah, just basically turn them into a mini disc player. You know, it's just like you're not relevant to the technological world anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, precisely. I think that is probably the most sustainable solution. There's discussion around things like making sure that the clients pay minimum wage, for example, in the place where the work's taking place. But all that's going to mean is that the clients will just choose to have work done in different parts of the world. Right, so they can still charge the lowest amount. It's not going to solve the inherent issue of the platform, It's just going to redistribute where the work is done. And then all that will happen is the most expensive jobs will be for native English speakers, and that's all that will remain.
Yeah. I mean, this, again, I feel like there's, we all have national interests, but as a true lefty, I am an internationalist, and this is actually one of the classic reasons why. Because unless we deal with something like this on a global scale, like you say, then they'll just find someone else to do it. If it becomes somehow impossible for them to do that, or certainly, you know, I mean, I don't think we're going to do it in one step. I think we're going to need
some
steps, and I think the implementation of things, the universal basics, in one place is what can then be hopefully transported around the world.
Exactly, as a proof of concept, essentially, you know, like, to see that it works would be awesome to see it go around the world. And I agree, it's the difficulty is in trying to find a solution that doesn't just pass the problem down the chain. You know, I mean, I don't think there's any point in solving the problem for workers here if it's going to intensify the problem for workers elsewhere.
It's
about this kind of global solidarity of workers and trying to figure out some sort of resistance or solution within wanting it to fit within that framework is quite difficult. But I'm trying to
solve it. Well, maybe one of the things that I'm thinking of here, and maybe I've just been watching and reading too much sci-fi, but I'm thinking that we are looking for this. Again, the solutions we're perhaps looking for are more physical, and maybe we need to be thinking more abstract and more like, you know, what can we do to these companies that effectively don't physically exist? I mean, by rights, I suppose the person who owns the platform, you know, has a base of operation, but that could be their living room. Same for the companies that advertise on it. They could just get up in the morning, you know, in your dressing gown, punch up the jobs you want people to do, and then go to the park. You know, or whatever, you just don't do anything the rest of the day. Yeah. So maybe it's all within the realms of the internet, of the you know, the virtual reality.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as well there's something to be said for making it visible as well, right? Because it can just exist in somebody's bedroom, that it's not very often seen. More broadly, like the people that if there are conspiracy readers, if there's a very small overlap in the Venn diagram between the conspiracy readers and this show, which I'm sure there's not. But if there are, I don't mean anything I said in that, right?
Yeah.
But something that's not visible is the fact that this is just churned out. And whether there's actually a kind of damage that can be done to the work, to the platforms, to say it's all churned out to out this stuff, it's just written, you know. So something I might well actually have any idea, but I might think about going back when I've finished this work and I'm away from it and don't have to worry about being kicked off the platform, just as in comments into all the little blogs that I've written of how much I earned for it. Do you know what I mean? To out it in its final place.
Yeah, fair enough. That would be a good move. I, as far as our audience is concerned, I have no idea if we have any conspiracy. Yeah, no idea.
I'm sure they're not daft enough to be reading conspiracy news.
You know, maybe they're reading it ironically.
Absolutely. Yeah. Which is allowed, to be fair. That's
fair enough. Yeah. You can, if they can turn it into a conspiracy theory, you can turn it into a joke. That's, I'm fine with that. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I just want to talk about, so you talked earlier on about, I think a very important term on an individual basis now, about how this work can be alienating.
Yeah.
And I was interested in that both from the individual level, but also as far as wider public life is concerned. You know, I wonder what this does to the public psyche going into the world of work. But you certainly don't seem alienated by this, at least, you know, you've turned it into, if possible, something positive in that you're writing about it and you're revealing to the world what, you know, the gig economy is really like. How do you manage to keep your head level? I mean, if that's not too personal a question.
Yeah, no. Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head in a lot of ways, that writing about it, although it is an extra labour, is part of trying to keep my head levelled with it.
Mm.
the feeling that somebody might be out there listening and seeing that it's not what it looks like, you know, that this work and putting the realities of the work out there is one way of kind of straightening it out, because it gives you a reason to reflect.
You've taken back a degree of control, even if it's a small degree.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, from within every one of these jobs, you're totally forced into the narrative that somebody else wants. Whereas for me now, this is my turn to have the narrative. Which, as small as it might well be, it's there's a feeling of kind of claiming some of that back, which has been really valuable. I think in terms of the public, though, because I guess I'm coming at it from this kind of odd spot, essentially. I think there's people that are really keen on this work sometimes, the people that have managed to somehow do well. There's, you know, a very small handful of people that are evangelical about it. And then most people, from the experiences I've had, are like, no, this is shit. This is rubbish. This is proper bad. But I think also in the kinds of services and everything like that, I mean, a lot of that would have passed through these hands. And the kind of future of work, or lack thereof, is intimately tied to this kind of cloud work. So, for example, there was a long series of jobs a while ago across different sites, which was basically trying to, from what we can gather anyway, build some sort of computational ethics for self-driving cars. So variations on the trolley problem, if you know that one, where it's like you have an out-of-control train car going down a track, the track's splitting up ahead of you, you're going to either hit like a small family of three people with a child, or you hit 20 grown men who are working on the train track. Do you pull the lever and kill the child and the family, or do you leave it on its course and have more casualties? Do you know what I mean? Trying to build these ethical problems into binary decisions. There's a lot of filling out these, but putting it into the space of cars. So it'll be you're driving your car, and you've got three options. You're going to crash. That's a certainty. Something's happened. You either go straight on and hit the thing in front of you, risking killing yourself. You either pull to the left, where there's a mother and child, both are wearing crash helmets. They will probably survive but be injured. Or you pull to the right, where there's somebody who's not wearing a crash helmet, will almost certainly die, but has chosen not to wear a crash helmet, basically. Right? So it gives you these three options, then you pick one. And there'll be several scenarios like that. Now, if that's operationalized into a car, the fact that somebody's being paid like 4p to half read through this thing and then just click A, B, or C because they need to get to the cash, and that's actually building part of our ethics, or part of the way that these autonomous vehicles of the future will be ethically conceiving things, is very worrying.
Yeah, I must say I'm moderately lost for words in response to that. The idea of as you say, and even then, to let's say whoever it is that's building this car, Google, for instance, if they've kind of outsourced ethical responsibility by going, well, we polled a bunch of people,
absolutely. So,
and they said, fuck it, hit the kid. You know, I mean,
that is a serious thing that could happen, right? And I mean, the prevalence of people not reading the questions in those types of things is so high. Most surveys will have a question that will be worded. There is no question. Press B. This is just to prove that you've been reading. And if you fail it, you don't get paid. Like, if you press the wrong one. But it's only as an act of defence from the person setting the question, because they know half the people are just not reading it and going tick, 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 you know, like in the French test when you're running out of time, just select B for all of them. it's that act of defence, essentially, from the surveys. So there will be people that are just ticking things. And, you know, I don't hold it against them for just ticking things either. It's you've got so little financial reward for the jobs that you're doing. You've got to do it that way. But you're absolutely right. It's extracting this data and then applying it to present situations, future situations. And it's, again, the afterlife of what's happening. In the same way that I didn't know this was ended up as a video, didn't know it would be explicitly shown as it was in the article, this kind of conspiracy bent on this original news article, when you're clicking through those things for building ethical decisions for a car, you don't know that that might one day end up in some terrible thing happening. You know, it's obviously not that one click on its own, but part of a corpus of lots of people doing it is this afterlife of your labour, which you're never told about.
Well, and I think also going back to your talk, which I saw you discussed how, for all you know, you could be helping someone build a weapon system or something, you know, which you have no interest in.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. It's, you have never have any idea. And it's, you know, I think there's a lot of people that have had a lot of jobs in traditional industries that have been building stuff without knowing. But when you're in a shared office and you're within an industry, within a company, it's a bit different, you know.
Yeah.
Like, there were mathematicians and physics working with Oppenheimer on the nuclear bomb that were just solving a mathematical problem. But they were in a space where, after a while, you'd begin to learn of what the hell was going on. Whereas this, it's also broken up and granular. It's, you can never quite get enough of the thread to pull.
I love conspiracies anyway. just on that, from a political point of view, and just on jobs, and I thought it was really interesting, not interesting, it was scary as well, in that if we take austerity, for example, just in, not necessarily what this particular subject, but overall it's jobs, isn't it? So we look at David Cameron, who talked about the big society and stuff. It was a very moderate conservative point of view. I thought it was Mark II Blair, personally. And that's the avenue he was going down. But then, obviously, he signed up to austerity. And what he did then, at the jot of a pen, which was quite frightening, he wiped out a third of workforce in Britain. Just like that. He just wiped out a third. So we look at Brexit, for example. Sorry to say that again. But we look at how us, the UK, as a workforce, how we're prepared for the digital revolution. And we're not. We're not prepared for it at all. Whereas you look at somewhere like Germany, who are way ahead in preparation for that. And I think, as you're talking about, I think in regards to digital stuff, it's already found a way to exploit workers in that field as well.
Yeah, massively. I mean, one of the things as well, which I haven't really mentioned as much, I mean, on the point about austerity, I'm in the same boat as you. I think it's a ridiculous, it's violent, it's all sorts of things that have been terrible, right? And you're right, David Cameron signed it away with a pen. But I mean, there's less talk of it in the UK, but more in the States, where actually quite a few more people do this type of work. There's this growing idea of the kind of people on, how do they package it there, is sort of welfare rather than you know, kind of people that are having food stamps to support their wage and all this kind of stuff, and have some sort of medical aid, are doing a lot of this work to top up their income, which is because they're put in a position where the money that they're given and the services that they're given are so measly that they have to try and top it up as much as possible. But it becomes a bit of a double narrative then, because then they become the welfare cheats, you know? So it puts people in this, in the crosshairs of two critiques, essentially. And all they're doing is trying to eke out a bit of a life. Like you say, with digital revolution kind of stuff, like this is, in many ways, if you're computer literate, a lot of this is easy enough, and then relatively low skilled. But if you're not computer literate, it's almost impenetrable to do, which is kind of two-sided as well. So, you know, with the loss of industry, you get people that are fantastically skilled workers that are having to turn to jobs like this, or very similar jobs in a more formalised way, that either they find impenetrable because, say, working with their hands, or they've worked with a particular computer system within the organisation. So something like this feels impenetrable and therefore demeaning. Or they're computer literate and it's so basic that it becomes really toxic to the kind of self-image, you know, and how you can hold yourself. And it's with, you know, with austerity, there's been this huge removal of of relatively skilled, even factory jobs that were really well skilled, that have had to be boiled down into shitty work like this.
Sometimes I'm going to put it out there. I think this current administration are of the view, or the 1922 committee, what the fuck they are. I think they just take the view, if it's foreign, we don't bother with it.
Everyone moans when the tube drivers go on strike. And they say, oh, blah, 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 they're not worth the money. But then the other news report is that the City of London today made 500 million less because the tube was on strike. And then you go, well, that's exactly how much they're worth to the city.
Right? Yeah.
Like, the same newspaper that says they're idiots for going on strike also comes out and puts a literal price tag on how much they're worth, and I guarantee it's more than what they'll be winning.
When Bill Clinton was in and looking, you know, wonderfully great, and just basically enacting all of Bush and Reagan's leftover policies, you know, he and Newt Gingrich were throwing people off of welfare lines. Where do you think they were going?
Yeah.
You know, yeah, exactly. Where were you then? You know, where were you? And you know, going, oh, I can't understand why people, you know, are lacking hope or have some resentment towards us. And that goes out to all the centrists in this country too. You know, all this kind of stuff. You complain about other people living in the past. Yeah, I completely agree, mate. I hate nostalgia. And you live in 1997.
I'm just going to go on about the US, and it's interesting about the US. So I always say about presidents and prime ministers, certainly in my lifetime, where I say in 30 years, prime ministers and presidents, I think 70% of that person is an actor. I think they're totally different people away. So we always vote for actors. They have to look a certain way. And secondly, in regard to US presidents, and this is quite interesting, I'll give you an example. So I think Trump appeals to a certain type of voter that Republican presidents have always relied on, which is the far right, or the Christian far right, and of course the NRA, the National Rifle Association, who are very influential. But we're seeing... So what happened, Bush got in just by whatever, with Al Gore, and obviously 9/11 and stuff. But he pissed off his traditional base, because he dropped them like a bad habit in 2004 before his second term, but he still got in. I'm seeing I'm seeing people like Bernie Sanders, Alexandra, oh, John can pronounce it.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
I think that's... When that happens... And the impact they're doing, I think it's such hope.
One of the funny things I find, or funny is not the right word, but you know, about the far right, is for all of their nationalist bluster, wherever they are in the world, they actually act quite internationalist. And many of us on the left have got really kind of afraid. Well, we're afraid of a lot of things, but we're afraid of kind of coming out in the kind of internationalist way I was talking about earlier, to kind of enact powers to stop these sort of jobs from crippling people's working lives. And I think, you know, we need to learn, because they can, you know, the level of, it's funny, because it's like the level of hypocrisy that you see on the right all of the time, and yet those on the left are sort of shit scared that someone's going to accuse us of it. But, you know, who gives a fuck? Just go and do what needs to be done.
I agree entirely on the whole hope front. I mean, it looks dark, but feasibly in 2 or 3 years' time, we could have somebody like Sanders in the White House and Corbyn in Downing Street. You know, I mean, there could be a sea change. It's really bipolar politics in a lot of ways, which, you know, is scary, because it might open the ground for the centre again and some form of new Labour or... like almost new Democrat style politicians come in. But I think there is a lively conversation around these ideas that are being freshened up again, you know, that were written off as in the dark ages of the 1970s by the kind of centrist pragmatists, but I think they're coming back and people are liking them. And I think history will treat particularly Sanders and again, how do we say him? Ocasio-Cortez, isn't it?
Ocasio-Cortez.
I think history will treat both of them really well, you know, at the minute anyway, as long as nothing goes totally wrong, in the way that it will not treat Clinton well, it will not treat Blair well, you know, it won't treat Cameron well. I think we're finally dealing with people that 70% of the acting is starting to decrease. Which is an exciting time. And just imagine, right? I mean, obviously the process could be made different, but if just some of that money that was funding jobs like this to write bullshit media for the alt-right was being used to farm clicks for the left, right? Like, it's not happening, but the left aren't thinking about it because the left are aware of the exploitation that happens in this workplace. So I'm not saying they should, but I'm just saying there's a world where things could be really different.
Yeah, I think I agree with that, and I think that we need to kind of engage with the situation that we have now, but also we need to get our heads out of kind of failed ideas. Like, there are some parts of, not the proper left, but some parts of at least the centre left have kind of relied a little bit on consumer activism, and to some degree, you know, I do it myself. I don't shop on Amazon, you know, I don't, you know, stuff like that, but I don't have any delusions about it that I'm actually really benefiting the world in any way, because Amazon, I mean, you know, I don't think Jeff Bezos has noticed that I don't shop at his fucking place.
It's one of those, isn't it, where if all we have left is consumer resistance, we're sort of fucked. But there is a space for it as well. Like, it's part of a suite of techniques, isn't it?
Oh, sure, and it's a good place to start. You know, it's like the thing I often say to people who say, well, I went on this protest and it didn't do anything about whatever it was about. And then I say to them, well, what was that protest? And if it turns out to be their first one, I say, well, what have you done since? And they go, well, I did this thing with these people that I met on that protest. And exactly. And I've got a radio show. And when I go to these events, if I find people's stuff that's interesting, I give them my number and say, you want to be on the radio sometime? I mean, this all comes from, you know, doing stuff. That's how you build those relationships, if I can use that awful term.
And I think as well, absolutely. And I think as well that we all know what it's like when you stood in the demo and you feel like it doesn't matter whether it happens or not. It feels like you have the power to change something. It's the first time in a lot of people's lives where you feel like, here we are, you know, something's going to change. And if it doesn't, and you go to the next one and the next one, it's... I think that's the thing. People think kind of revolutions and massive changes in behaviour start overnight, and they're not, you know. There are obviously these rapid flare-ups that we see, but that's off the back of huge amounts of discontent and huge amounts of action that have been bubbling under for ages. Being part of that. And like you say, it's the people you meet, and not only what you then do afterwards, but the way that you then shape each other's ideas, right? Because the left needs to be robust. And having people that otherwise would never be seen dead in a protest come out to protest about something, figuring out why they were there and getting them into the fold, I think, is absolutely critical.
Coming back to this weekend, you know, I see this, a very good example here that we could look at some of the people that came out in that demo and we could be a bit sneery. And when I say we, I mean me. I could be a little bit sneery and look at it and go, oh, so this got you out. So, as Dave mentioned, food banks hasn't got you out in the street. Or, you know. But then another part of it could be saying, well, how do I put that to people in another way? Which is to say, look, you came out in the street because you thought Brexit was about to completely clusterfuck this country into the ground. Do you think it's fair that people are suffering austerity? Do you think it's fair that they're having to rely on food banks? Do you think it's fair that someone like yourself, Adam, is having to do the work that you're doing? And if quite often they respond to that, no, they don't think it's fair. And if we assume that they're being sincere, I'm giving them a very long rope here, but if we assume they're being sincere, then the argument there is, so what do we do to get you out to fight for these things then?
And it's, you know, it's, I think we've all, you know, those of us that have been worn down by the career pragmatists of the centre have started to build up these techniques, haven't we? And you know, like mine, for example, is I'll get people that will say, oh, I'm a biggish free market guy, I think the market will solve everything. And I'm like, I bet you're not. and I mean, the UK is a peculiar example because Britain loves its NHS, doesn't it? It loves the idea of a free schooling system, and it loves the idea of fairness, I think. Yeah, some people equate that to the market. But yeah, I've got these three simple questions that I always ask people. It's one, do you think that you should have free education just up to the point of 18, right? I don't want to push it too far and lose them early on. But just up to the point of 18, should you have free education? Yes. If you're ill, if you're sick, should it matter how much money you earn? Depends on whether you can get treated and made better. No, you should have free healthcare. Yes. And do you think if you work 40 hours a week, you should have a roof over your head? Yes. You know, should you be able to afford the basics of life? Well, it's like, yes, well, then welcome. You're at the least a socialist. and we'll talk about what you might actually be from there. Because if you believe these kind of three halves of what make our society, then you're not quite as ruthless free market as you think you are, you know. And It's not to try and get one up on people, but it's just to say, look, there's these things that you've taken for granted because they happened a long time ago now. That actually, maybe you're not quite the ruthless person you think you are, and that's not a bad thing.
Centre-right element of this that goes, well, you know, yeah, we can still have free healthcare, but only for English people, you know, that are white. Or something like that, you know, because I can, oh, jokes aside, I can see that argument happening. I wish to fuck I couldn't see it happening.
But, yeah, but you don't even have to imagine it. You know, the health tourist headlines.
Yeah.
They're all there. And it's not health tourists that are ruining our NHS. They are a tiny, 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 insignificant fraction of what is spent. Even if you think that they shouldn't have a right to be here, which I don't. But even if you think that, right, as a proportion of the spending in the NHS, it's... like so small compared to the amount that we're levering off to essentially Virgin, to other private contractors. You know, it's mad. It's mad.
Coming back to the beginning, as it were. So coming back to the invisible worker, this zine that Robbie put together. Issue one, the platform worker, which is the one I'm holding at the moment. How did you get involved with that? And would do you like zines in general? You know, do you think they're a good way of communicating ideas or creativity, stuff like that?
I think they're a fantastic medium. I mean, how did I get involved? So Robbie and I are kind of, he's very much taking the lead on it. But I've ended up being kind of a sort of co-conspirator in some of it now, which is good fun for me. Because I get to see behind the veil of what's happening, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic. And actually, if there's anyone that would ever be interested in contributing or in kind of leading an issue, if they've got an idea that they think would make something that isn't being spoken about in the Invisible Worker, let us know. We're trying to keep it as open as possible. But I think that's I think they're as much as you make of them, essentially. Like Robbie's been fantastic in it, always been open. You know, it's not about just getting one group of people to write for that audience. It's about trying to smush things together and try and not only make sure there's stuff that anyone can access in there, but also that those different ways of communicating ideas tease out different ways of thinking. Because it ends up being kind of kaleidoscopic in a lot of ways, I guess. It's lots and lots of different bits kind of loosely curated together. Under a theme, but not just an academic paper or a white paper or a legal document or something equally impenetrable, you know. So I think, you know, what's the first question anyone asks you? What do you do? You know, work is in our everyday lives, so keeping it elevated to the sphere of impenetrable is useless to some degree. So having it open and in an accessible format, I think, is really cool. But yeah, I wasn't initially really involved in zines before. It's the first one I've really worked on. You know, I've bought zines at kind of like markets and stuff like that in the past that have taken my eye, and in all number of excellent bookshops in London. Like the Left Bookshop is a good fan of the zine, actually, isn't it? But otherwise, it's the first time I've been involved in really making one. And yeah, it was fun to make. I think they could occupy a really interesting position now, particularly, you know, as we were saying earlier, we've got this new group of voters that the establishment have ignored. But groups like Momentum and the Labour Party and, you know, Bernie Sanders and people have been very good at picking up on is this is perhaps a new way as well to start looking at how we're doing union outputs sometimes, right? The stigma of the union paper could perhaps, you know, work well as a zine. I don't know. Maybe, but I mean, there's also a long tradition of union papers, which is fantastic. But is there a way to tap into that younger demographic of voters that have a different idea on what they're standing for, I suppose?
So just in closing, I'll say, certainly, firstly, Adam Badger, thanks very much for being on All The Rage, and solidarity, and you listen, everyone, you know, you've been listening to what we've been talking about this evening. There's only one way to get us out of this world, and it's collective action. You know, we have to make the working world better, and we have to do it all together. Adam, thanks a lot, mate. Really good to talk to you, and anytime you want to come back on the show, anything else you want to talk about, let me know. Happy to have you on.
Let me know. It's been a real pleasure.
All the Rage with John Bowd. www.tracksfm.org.